That makes you somebody. And you practiced the accent, and how to hold your utensils, and knelt your way to special missions, and now I'm your special mission. You've got to bring me home in one piece, even though you'd rather not, wouldn't you? You've got a problem with me. At a guess, your problem is that try all you like, whoever you kneel to, you'll never be what I was born to be, and people like you hate that. I turned toward her. I'm certain my face was without expression, but when my eyes met hers, she flinched. No edge taken off, none at all, and took three quick reflexive steps backward, over the edge of the bridge. I stepped to the edge, looked down. Savardin hung 6 meters below, hands clenched around a complicated swirl of red glass. Her eyes wide, mouth open slightly. She looked up at me and said, "You were going to hit me!" The calculations came easily to me. All my clothes knotted would only reach 5.7 meters. The red glass was connected somewhere under the bridge. I couldn't see. No sign of anything she could climb. The colored glass wasn't as strong as the bridge itself. I guessed the red spiral would shatter under Savardin's weight sometime in the next 3 to 7 seconds. Though that was only a guess. Still, any help I might call would certainly arrive too late. Clouds still veiled the bottom reaches of the chasm. Those tubes were just a few centimeters narrower than my outstretched arms, and were themselves very deep.
"Brack!"
Savardin's voice was breathy and strained.
"Can you do something?"
"Not, at least, you have to do something." "Do you trust me?" I asked. Her eyes widened further, her gasps became a bit more ragged. She didn't trust me, I knew. She was only still with me because she thought I was official, hence inescapable, and she was important enough for the Rach to send someone after her. Underestimating her own importance was never one of Savardin's failings. And perhaps because she was tired of running from the world, from herself. Ready to give up. But I still didn't understand why I was with her. Of all the officers I've served with, she was never one of my favorites.
"I trust you," she lied.
"When I grab you, raise your armor and put your arms around me." Fresh alarm flashed across her face, but there was no more time. I extended my armor under my clothes and stepped off the bridge. The instant my hands touched her shoulders, the red glass shattered, sharp-edged fragments flying out and away, glittering briefly. Savardin closed her eyes, ducked her head, face into my neck, held me tight enough that if I hadn't been armored, my breathing would have been impeded. Because of the armor, I couldn't feel her panicked breath on my skin, couldn't feel the air rushing past, though I could hear it. But she didn't extend her own armor. If I had been more than just myself, if I had had the numbers I needed, I could have calculated our terminal velocity and just how long it would take to reach it. Gravity was easy, but the drag of my pack and our heavy coats, whipping up around us, affecting our speed was beyond me. It would have been much easier to calculate in a vacuum, but we weren't falling in a vacuum. But the difference between 50 meters a second and 150 was, at the moment, only large in the abstract. I couldn't see the bottom yet. The target I was hoping to hit was small, and I didn't know how much time we'd have to adjust our attitude, if we even could. For the next 20 to 40 seconds, we had nothing to do but wait and fall.
"Armor!" I shouted into Savardin's ear. "Sold it," she answered.
Her voice shook slightly, straining against the rushing air. Her face was still pressed hard against my neck. Suddenly, gray. Moisture formed on exposed portions of my armor and blew streaming upward.
1.35 seconds later, I saw the ground, dark circles packed tight, bigger, and therefore closer than I liked. A surge of adrenaline surprised me. I must have gotten too used to falling. I turned my head, trying to look straight down past Savardin's shoulder to what lay directly below us. My armor was made to spread out the force of a bullet's impact, bleed some of it away as heat. It was theoretically impenetrable, but I could still be injured or even killed with the application of sufficient force. I'd suffered broken bones, lost bodies under an unrelenting hail of bullets. I wasn't sure what the friction of decelerating would do to my armor, or to me. I had some skeletal and muscular augmentation, but whether it would be sufficient for this, I had no idea. I was unable to calculate just exactly how fast we were going, just exactly how much energy needed to be bled away to slow to a survivable speed, how hot it would get inside and outside my armor. And unarmored, Savardin wouldn't be able to assist. Of course, if I had still been what I once was, it wouldn't matter. This wouldn't have been my only body. I couldn't help thinking I should have let Savardin fall. Shouldn't have jumped. Falling, I still didn't know why I had done it. But at the moment of choice, I had found I couldn't walk away. By then I knew our distance in centimeters. 5 seconds, I said, shouted, above the wind. By then it was 4. If we were very, very lucky, we'd fall straight into the tube below us, and I'd push my hands and feet against the walls. If we were very, very lucky, the heat from the friction wouldn't burn unarmored Savardin too badly. If I was even luckier, I'd only break my wrists and ankles. All of it struck me as unlikely, but the omens would fall as Amat intended. Falling didn't bother me. I could fall forever and not be hurt. It's stopping that's the problem. 3 seconds, I said. Breck, Savardin said, a gasping sob. Please. Some answers I would never have. I abandoned what calculations I was still making. I didn't know why I had jumped, but at that moment it no longer mattered. At that moment, there was nothing else. Whatever you do, 1 second, don't let go. Darkness. No impact. I thrust out my arms, which were immediately forced upward, wrists and one ankle breaking on impact, despite my armor's reinforcement, tendons and muscles tearing, and we began a tumble sideways. Despite the pain, I pulled my arms and legs in and reached and kicked out again, quickly, steadying us the instant after. Something in my right leg broke as I did, but I couldn't afford to worry about it. Centimeter by centimeter, we slowed. I could no longer control my hands or feet, could only push against the walls and hope we wouldn't be pushed off balance again and fall helpless, head first, to our deaths. The pain was sharp, blinding, blocking out everything except numbers. A distance, estimated. Decreasing by centimeters, also estimated. Speed, estimated, decreasing. External armor temperature, increasing at my extremities. Possible danger of exceeding acceptable parameters. Possible resulting injury. But the numbers were near meaningless to me. The pain was louder, more immediate than anything else. But the numbers were important. A comparison of distance and our rate of deceleration suggested disaster ahead. I tried to take a deep breath, found I was incapable of it, and tried to push harder against the walls. I have no memory of the rest of the descent. I woke on my back in pain, my hands and arms, my shoulders, feet and legs. In front of me, directly above, a circle of gray light. Savardin, I tried to say, but it came out as a convulsive sigh that echoed just slightly against the walls. "Save Arden." The name came out this time, but barely audible and distorted by my armor. I dropped the armor and tried speaking again, managing this time to engage my voice. "Save Arden." I raised my head just slightly. In the dim light from above, I saw that I lay on the ground, knees bent and turned to one side, the right leg at a disturbing angle, my arms straight beside my body. I tried to move a finger. Failed. A hand. Failed, of course. I tried shifting my right leg, which responded with more pain. There was no one here but me. Nothing here but me. I didn't see my pack. At one time, if there had been a Rodchai ship in orbit, I could have contacted it easy as thought. But if I had been anywhere a Rodchai ship was likely to be, this would never have happened. If I had left Save Arden in the snow, this would never have happened. I had been so close. After 20 years of planning and working, of maneuvering, 2 steps forward here, 1 step backward there, slowly, patiently, against all likelihood, I had gotten this far. So many times I had made a throw like this, not only my success at hazard, but my life. And each time I had won, or at least not lost in any way that prevented me from trying again. Until now. And for such a stupid reason. Above me, clouds hid the unreachable sky. The future I no longer had. The goal I was now incapable of accomplishing. Failed. I closed my eyes against tears not brought on by physical pain. If I failed, it wouldn't be because I had ever at any time given up. Save Arden had left somehow. I would find her. I would rest a moment, recollect myself, find the strength to pull out the handheld I kept in my coat, and call for help, or discover some other way to leave here. And if it meant I dragged myself out on the bloody, useless remains of my limbs, I would do that, pain or no pain, or I would die trying. Chapter 14. One of the three Mianais didn't even arrive at the VAR deck, but transmitted the code for my central access deck. Invalid access, I thought, receiving it, but stopped the lift on that level and opened the door anyway. That Mianai made her way to my main console, gestured up records, scanned quickly through a century of log headings, stopped, frowned, at a point in the list that would have been made in the 5 years surrounding that last visit that I had concealed from her. The other two of her stowed their bags in quarters and went to the newly lit and slowly warming VAR decade room. Both of her sat at the table, the silent colored glass Valskyan saint smiling mildly down. Without speaking aloud, she requested information from me. A random sample of memories from that 5-year span that had so attracted her attention, above on the central access deck. Silent, expressionless, unreal in a sense, since I could only see her exteriors, she watched as my memories played out before her visions, in her ears. I began to doubt the truth of my memory of that other visit. There seemed to be no trace of it in the information Anander Mianai was accessing. Nothing during that time but routine operations. But something had attracted her attention to that stretch of time. And there was that invalid access to account for. None of Anander Mianai's accesses were ever invalid, never could be. And why had I opened to an invalid access? And when one Anander, in the VAR decade room, frowned and said, "No, nothing," and the Lord of the Roch turned her attention to more recent memories, I found myself tremendously relieved. In the meantime, my captain and all my other officers went about the routine business of the day, training, exercising, eating, talking, completely unaware that the Lord of the Roch was aboard. The whole thing was wrong. The Lord of the Roch watched my esk-lieutenant's fencing over breakfast, 3 times, with no visible change of expression. One var set tea at the elbow of each of the 2 identical, black-clad bodies in the var decade room.
"Lieutenant On," said one Anander, "has she been out of your presence at all since the incident?"
She hadn't specified which incident she meant, but she could only have meant the business in the Temple of Ikt. "She has not, my lord," I said, using one var's mouth. On my central access deck, the Lord of the Roch keyed accesses and overrides that would allow her to change nearly anything about my mind she wished. Invalid, 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 one after another. But each time I flashed acknowledgement, confirmed access she didn't actually have. I felt something like nausea, beginning to realize what must have happened, but having no accessible memory of it to confirm my suspicions, to make the matter clear and unambiguous to me.
"Has she at any time discussed this incident with anyone?"
This much was clear. Anander Mianai was acting against herself. Secretly, she was divided in 2, at least 2. I could only see traces of the other Anander, the one who had changed the accesses she thought she was only now changing to favor herself.
"Has she at any time discussed this incident with anyone?"
"Briefly, my lord," I said, truly frightened for the first time in my long life. "With Lieutenant Skyot of Justice of Ente." How could my voice, one var, speak so calmly? How could I even know what words to say, what answer to make, when the whole basis for all my actions, even my reason for existence, was thrown into doubt? One me and I frowned, not the one that had been speaking.
"Skyot,"
she said with slight distaste, seeming unaware of my sudden fear.
"I've had my suspicions about Auer for some time."
Auer was Lieutenant Skyot's house name. But what that had to do with events in the Temple of Ikt, I had no idea.
"I never could find any proof."
This also was mysterious to me.
"Play me the conversation."
When Lieutenant Skyot said, "If you're going to do something that crazy, save it for when it'll make a difference," one body leaned forward sharply and gave a breathy, "Ha!" an angry sound. Moments later, at the mention of Ime, eyebrows twitched. I feared momentarily that my dismay at the incautious, frankly dangerous tenor of that conversation would be detectable to the Lord of the Roch, but she made no mention of it. Hadn't seen it, perhaps, as she hadn't seen my profound disturbance at realizing she was no longer one person but 2 in conflict with each other.
"Not proof, not enough,"
me and I said, oblivious.
"But dangerous. Auer ought to tip my way."
Why she thought this, I didn't immediately understand. Auer had come from the Roch itself. From the start, had had wealth and influence enough to allow it to criticize, and criticize it did, though generally with shrewdness enough to keep itself out of real trouble. I had known our house for a long time, had carried its young lieutenants, known them as captains of other ships. Granted, no hour suited for military service exhibited her house's tendencies to their utmost extent.
an overly keen sense of injustice or a tendency to mysticism didn't mesh well with annexations, nor with wealth and rank. Any hour's moral outrage inevitably smelled slightly of hypocrisy, considering the comforts and privileges such an ancient house enjoyed. And while some injustices were unignorably obvious to them, some others they never saw. In any event, Lieutenant Skyot's sardonic practicality wasn't foreign to her house. It was only a milder, more livable version of Auer's tendency to moral outrage. Doubtless, Ichenander thought her cause was the more just. The more proper, the more beneficial, certainly. Assuming Auer's penchant for just causes, the citizens of that house ought to support the proper side, given they knew anything like sides were involved at all. This assumed, of course, that any part at all of Anander Mianai thought any Auer was guided by a passion for justice and not by self-interest covered over with self-righteousness. And any given Auer could, at various times, be guided by either. Still, it was possible some part of Anander Mianai thought that Auer, or any particular Auer, needed only to be convinced of the justice of her cause to champion it. And surely she knew that if Auer, any Auer, couldn't be convinced, it would be her implacable enemy.
Suler now, Anander Mianai turned to Wanvar, standing silent at the table. Dariot Suler seems to be an ally of Lieutenant On. Why?
The question troubled me for reasons I couldn't quite identify. I can't be entirely certain, my lord, but I believe Lieutenant Dariot considers Lieutenant On to be an able officer, and of course she defers to Lieutenant On as decade senior. And perhaps was secure enough in her own standing not to resent Lieutenant On's having authority over her. Unlike Lieutenant Isaiah, but I didn't say that.
Nothing to do with political sympathies, then?
I'm at a loss to understand what you mean, my lord, I said, quite sincerely but with growing alarm. Another Mianai body spoke up.
Are you playing stupid with me, ship?
Begging my lord's pardon, I answered, still speaking through Wanvar. If I knew what my lord was looking for, I would be better able to supply relevant data. In answer, Mianai said,
Justice of Torin, when did I last visit you?
If those accesses and overrides had been valid, I would have been utterly unable to conceal anything from the Lord of the Roch. 203 years, 4 months, 1 week, and 5 days ago, my lord, I lied, now sure of the significance of the question.
Give me your memories of the incident in the temple, Mianai commanded, and I complied.
And lied again. Because while nearly every instant of each of those individual streams of memory and data was unaltered, that moment of horror and doubt when one segment feared it might have to shoot Lieutenant On was, impossibly, missing. It seems very straightforward when I say, I. At the time, I meant Justice of Torin, the whole ship and all its ancillaries. A unit might be very focused on what it was doing at that particular moment, but it was no more apart from me than my hand is while it's engaged in a task that doesn't require my full attention. Nearly 20 years later, I would be a single body, a single brain. That division, I, Justice of Torin, and I, one-esque, wasn't, I have come to think, a sudden split, not an instant before which I was one and after which I was we. It was something that had always been possible, always potential, guarded against. But how did it go from potential to real, incontrovertible, irrevocable?
On one level, the answer is simple. It happened when all of Justice of Torin but me was destroyed. But when I look closer, I seem to see cracks everywhere. Did the singing contribute? The thing that made one Esk different from all other units of the ship? Indeed, in the fleets? Perhaps. Or is anyone's identity a matter of fragments held together by convenient or useful narrative that in ordinary circumstances never reveals itself as a fiction? Or is it really a fiction? I don't know the answer, but I do know that, though I can see hints of the potential split going back 1,000 years or more, that's only hindsight. The first I noticed even the bare possibility that I, Justice of Torin, might not also be I-1-esque, was that moment that Justice of Torin edited 1-esque's memory of the slaughter in the Temple of Ikt. The moment I was surprised by it. It makes the history hard to convey, because still, I was me, unitary, one thing, and yet I acted against myself, contrary to my interests and desires, sometimes secretly, deceiving myself as to what I knew and did. And it's difficult for me even now to know who performed what actions or knew which information. Because I was Justice of Torin. Even when I wasn't. Even if I'm not anymore. Above, on Esk, Lieutenant Dariot asked for admittance to Lieutenant On's quarters, found Lieutenant On lying on her bunk, staring sightlessly up, gloved hands behind her head. On, she began. Stopped, made a rueful smile. I'm here to pry. I can't talk about it, answered Lieutenant On, still staring up, dismayed and angry, but not letting it reach her voice. In the Var Decade room, me and I asked,
What are Dariot Sulaire's political sympathies?
I believe she has none to speak of, I answered, with Onevar's mouth. Lieutenant Dariot stepped into Lieutenant On's quarters, sat on the edge of the bed, next to Lieutenant On's unbooted feet.
Not about that. Have you heard from Skyot?
Lieutenant On closed her eyes, still dismayed, still angry, but with a slightly different feel. Why should I have? Lieutenant Dariot was silent for 3 seconds.
I like Skyot. She said finally. I know she likes you.
I was there. I was there and convenient. You know, we all know we'll be moving sometime soon. And once we do, Skyot has no reason to care whether or not I exist anymore. And even if... Lieutenant On stopped, swallowed, breathed. Even if she did... She continued, her voice just barely less steady than before. It wouldn't matter. I'm not anyone she wants to be connected with. Not anymore. If I ever was. Below, Anander Mianai said,
Lieutenant Dariot seems pro-reform.
That puzzled me. But Onevar had no opinion, of course, being only Onevar, and it had no physical response to my puzzlement. I saw suddenly, clearly, that I was using Onevar as a mask, though I didn't understand why or how I would do such a thing, or why the idea would occur to me now. Begging my lord's pardon, I don't see that as a political stance.
Don't you?
No, my lord. You ordered the reforms. Loyal citizens will support them. That me and I smiled. The others stood, left the decade room to walk the Var corridors, inspecting. Not speaking to or acknowledging in any way the segments of Onevar it passed. Lieutenant On said to Lieutenant Dariot's skeptical silence, It's easy for you.
Nobody thinks you're kneeling for advantage when you go to bed with someone. Or getting above yourself. Nobody wonders what your partner could be thinking or how you ever got here. I've told you before, you're too sensitive about that.
Am I?
Lieutenant Ahn opened her eyes, levered herself on her elbows.
How do you know? Have you experienced it much?
I have, all the time.
That, said Mianai in the decade room, is a more complicated issue than many realize. Lieutenant Ahn is pro-reform, of course.
I wished I had physical data from Mianai so I could interpret the edge in her voice when she named Lieutenant Ahn.
And Dariot, perhaps, though how strongly is a question. And the rest of the officers? Who here are pro-reform and who anti?
In Lieutenant Ahn's quarters, Lieutenant Dariot sighed. I just think you worry too much about it. Who cares what people like that say?
It's easy not to care when you're rich and the social equal of people like that.
That sort of thing shouldn't matter, Lieutenant Dariot insisted.
It shouldn't, but it does.
Lieutenant Dariot frowned, angry and frustrated. This conversation had happened before, had gone the same way each time. Well, regardless, you should send Skyot a message. What is there to lose? If she doesn't answer, she doesn't answer. But maybe...
Lieutenant Dariot lifted one shoulder and her arm just slightly. A gesture that said, take a chance and see what fate deals you. If I hesitated in answering Anander Mianai's question for even the smallest instant, she would know the overrides weren't working. One Var was very, very impassive. I named a few officers who had definite opinions one way or the other. The rest, I finished, are content to follow orders and perform their duties without worrying too much about policy, as far as I can tell.
They might be swayed one way or the other, Mianai observed.
I couldn't say, my lord.
My sense of dread increased, but in a detached way. Perhaps the absolute unresponsiveness of my ancillaries made the feeling seem distant and unreal. Ships I knew who had exchanged their ancillary crews for human ones had said their experience of emotion had changed, though this didn't seem quite like the data they had shown me. The sound of one-esque singing came faintly to Lieutenant Ahn and Lieutenant Dariot, a simple song with two parts.
I was walking, when I met my love. I was in the street walking, when I saw my true love. I said, she is more beautiful than jewels, lovelier than jade or lapis, silver or gold.
I'm glad one-esque is itself again, said Lieutenant Dariot. That first day was eerie.
Two-esque didn't sing, Lieutenant Ahn pointed out.
Right, but...
Lieutenant Dariot gestured doubt.
It wasn't right.
She looked speculatively at Lieutenant Ahn.
I can't talk about it, said Lieutenant Ahn, and lay back down, crossing her arms over her eyes.
On the command deck, Hundred Captain Rubrin met with the decade commanders, drank tea, talked about schedules and leave times.
You haven't mentioned Hundred Captain Rubrin, said Mianai in the Var decade room.
I hadn't. I knew Captain Rubrin extremely well. Knew her every breath, every twitch of every muscle. She had been my captain for 56 years. I have never heard her express an opinion on the matter, I said, quite truthfully.
Never? Then it's certain she has one and is concealing it.
This struck me as something of a double bind. Speak, and your possession of an opinion was plain, clear to anyone. Refrain from speaking, and still, this was proof of an opinion. If Captain Rubrun were to say, "Truly, I have no opinion on the matter," would that merely be another proof she had one?
"Surely she's been present when others have discussed it," Mianai continued. "What have her feelings been in such cases?"
"Exasperation," I answered through one var. "Impatience, sometimes boredom."
"Exasperation," mused Mianai. "At what, I wonder?"
I didn't know the answer, so I said nothing.
"Her family connections are such that I can't be certain where her sympathies are most likely to lie, and some of them I don't want to alienate before I can move openly. I have to tread carefully with Captain Rubrun, but so will she."
She, meaning, of course, herself. There had been no attempt to discover my sympathies. Perhaps, no, certainly they were irrelevant. And I was already well along the path the other Mianai had set me on. These few Mianais and the four segments of one var thawed for her service only made the var deck seem emptier, and all the decks between here and my engines. Hundreds of thousands of ancillaries slept in my holds, and they would likely be removed within the next few years, either stored or destroyed, never waking again. And I would be placed in orbit somewhere permanently, my engines almost certainly disabled, or I would be destroyed outright, though none of us had been so far, and I was fairly sure I would more likely serve as a habitat or the core of a small station. Not the life I had been built for.
"No, I can't be hasty with Rubrun Osk. But your Lieutenant Awn is another matter, and perhaps she can be of use in discovering where our stands."
"My lord," I said through one of Onevar's mouths, "I'm at a loss to understand what's happening. I would feel a great deal more comfortable if the Hundred Captain knew you were here."
"You dislike concealing things from your captain?"
Anander asked, with a tone that was equal parts bitter and amused. "Yes, my lord. I will, of course, proceed precisely as you order me." A sudden sense of déjà vu overcame me.
"Of course, I should explain some things."
The sense of déjà vu grew stronger. I had had this conversation before, in almost exactly these circumstances, with the Lord of the Roch. "You know that each of your ancillary segments is entirely capable of having its own identity," she would say next.
"You know that each of your ancillary segments is entirely capable of having its own identity."
Yes. Every word familiar. I could feel it, as though we were reciting lines we had memorized. Next, she would say, "Imagine you became undecided about something."
"Imagine some enemy separated part of you from yourself."
Not what I had been expecting. What is it people say when that happens? They're divided, they're of two minds.
"Imagine that enemy managed to forge or force its way past all the necessary accesses, and that part of you came back to you, but wasn't really part of you anymore, but you didn't realize it. Not right away."
You and I, we really can be of two minds, can't we? "That's a very alarming thought, my lord."
"It is,"
agreed Anander Mianai, all the time sitting in the var decade room, inspecting the corridors and rooms of the var deck, watching Lieutenant Awn, alone again, and miserable, gesturing through my mind on the central access deck, or so she thought.
"I don't know precisely who has done it. I suspect the involvement of the Presger. They've been meddling in our affairs since before the treaty. And after, 500 years ago, the best surgicals and correctives were made in Roch space. Now we buy from the Presger. At first, only at border stations, but now they're everywhere. 800 years ago, the translator's office was a collection of minor officials who assisted in the interpretation of extra-Roch intelligence and who smoothed linguistic problems during annexations. Now they dictate policy. Chief among them, the emissary to the Presger.
The last sentence was spoken with audible distaste.
Before the treaty, the Presger destroyed a few ships. Now they destroy all of Roch civilization. Expansion, annexation is very expensive. Necessary, it has been from the beginning. From the first, to surround the Roch itself with a buffer zone, protecting it from any sort of attack or interference. Later, to protect those citizens, and to expand the reach of civilization. And...
Me and I stopped, gave a short, exasperated sigh.
To pay for the previous annexations, to provide wealth for Rajshai in general.
My lord, what do you suspect the Presger of having done? But I knew. Even with my memory obscured and incomplete, I knew.
Divided me, corrupted part of me, and the corruption has spread. The other me has been recruiting, not only more parts of me, but also my own citizens, my own soldiers.
My own ships.
My own ships. I can only guess what her goal is, but it can't be anything good.
Do I understand correctly, I asked, already knowing the answer, that this other Anander Mianai is the force behind the ending of annexations?
She will destroy everything I've built.
I had never seen the Lord of the Roch so frustrated and angry, had not thought her capable of it.
Do you realize, there's no reason you should ever have thought of it, that it's the appropriation of resources during annexations that drives our economy?
I'm afraid, my lord, that I'm only a troop carrier and have never concerned myself with such things. But what you say makes sense.
And you, I doubt you're looking forward to losing your ancillaries.
Outside my distant companions, the justices parked around the system, sat silent, waiting. How many of them had received this visit, or both these visits? I am not, my lord.
I can't promise that I can prevent it. I'm not prepared for open warfare. All my moves are in secret, pushing here, pulling there, making sure of my resources and support. But in the end, she is me, and there's little I can do she won't already have thought of. She has outmaneuvered me several times already. It's why I've been so cautious in approaching you. I wanted to be sure she hadn't already suborned you.
I felt it was safer not to comment on that, and instead said, through one var, My lord, the guns in the lake in oars. Was that your enemy? I almost asked. But if we were faced with two Ananders, each opposing the other, how did anyone know which was which?
Events in Oars didn't come out precisely the way I wished, answered Anander Mianai. I never expected anyone would find those guns, but if some Oarsian fisherman had found them and said nothing, or even taken them, my purpose would still have been served.
Instead, Denzai had reported her find to Lieutenant On. The Lord of the Roch hadn't expected that, I saw. Hadn't thought the Orzians trusted Lieutenant On that much.
I didn't get what I wanted there, but perhaps the results will still serve my purpose. Hundred Captain Rubrin is about to receive orders to depart this system for Valskai. It was past time for you to leave, and you would have a year ago if not for the Divine of Ict's insistence that Lieutenant On stay, and my own opposition. Whether knowingly or not, Lieutenant On is the instrument of my enemy, I'm certain of it.
I didn't trust even Onevar's impassivity to answer that, and therefore didn't speak. Above, on the central access deck, the Lord of the Roch continued to make changes, give orders, alter my thoughts, still believing she could, in fact, do that. No one was surprised at the order to depart. Four other justices already had in the last year, to destinations meant to be final. But neither I nor any of my officers had expected Valsky, six gates away. Valsky, that I had been sorry to leave. 100 years ago, in the city of Vestris Kor, on Valsky itself, One Esk had discovered volume upon volume of elaborate, multi-voiced choral music, all intended for the rites of Valsky's troublesome religion, some of it dating from before humans had ever reached space. Downloaded everything it found so that it hardly regretted being sent away from such a treasure out to the countryside. Hard work prying rebels from a reserve, forest and caverns and springs, that we couldn't just blast because it was a watershed for half the continent. A region of small rivers and bluffs and farms, grazing sheep and peach orchards, and music. Even the rebels, trapped at last, had sung, either in defiance against us or as consolation for themselves, their voices reaching my appreciative ears as I stood at the mouth of the cave where they hid.
Death will overtake us in whatever manner, already fated. Everyone falls to it, and so long as I'm ready, I don't fear it, no matter what form it takes.
When I thought of Valsky, I thought of sunshine and the sweet, bright taste of peaches, thought of music. But I was sure I wouldn't be sent down to the planet this time. There would be no orchards for One Esk, no visits, unofficial, as unobtrusive as possible, to Choral Society meetings. Traveling to Valsky, I wouldn't, it turned out, take the gates, but generate my own, moving more directly. The gates most travelers used had been generated millennia ago, were held constantly open, stable, surrounded by beacons broadcasting warnings, notifications, information about local regulations and navigation hazards. Not only ships, but messages and information streamed constantly through them. In the 2,000 years I'd been alive, I'd used them once. Like all Rodchai warships, I was capable of making my own shortcut. It was more dangerous than using the established gates. An error in my calculations could send me anywhere or nowhere, never to be heard from again. And since I left no structures behind to hold my gate open, I traveled in a bubble of normal space, isolated from everyone and everywhere, until I exited at my destination. I didn't make such errors, and in the course of arranging an annexation, the isolation could be an advantage. Now, though, the prospect of months alone, with Anander, me, and I secretly occupying my var deck, made me nervous. Before I gated out, a message came from Lieutenant Skyot for Lieutenant On. Brief. I said, keep in touch. I meant it. Lieutenant Dariot said,
see, I told you.
But Lieutenant On...
didn't answer. Chapter 15. At some point I opened my eyes again, thinking I had heard voices. All around me, blue. I tried to blink, found I could only close my eyes and leave them closed. Sometime later I opened my eyes again, turned my head to the right, and saw Save Arden and the girl squatting on either side of a tick-tick board. So I was dreaming, or hallucinating. At least I no longer hurt, which on consideration was a bad sign. But I couldn't bring myself to care much. I closed my eyes again. I woke, finally actual wakefulness, and found myself in a small blue-walled room. I lay in bed, and on a bench beside it, Save Arden sat, leaning against the wall, looking as though she hadn't slept recently. Or that is to say, even more as though she hadn't slept recently than she usually did. I lifted my head. My arms and legs were immobilized by correctives.
"You're awake," said Save Arden.
I set my head back down. "Where's my pack?"
"Right here."
She bent, lifted it into my line of sight. "We're at the medical center in Therid," I guessed, and closed my eyes.
"Yes. Do you think you can talk to the doctor? Because I can't understand anything she says."
I remembered my dream.
"You learned to play tick-tick?" "That's different."
So not a dream.
"You sold the flyer."
No answer. "You bought Kef."
"No, I didn't," she protested. "I was going to, but when I woke up and you were gone..."
I heard her shift uncomfortably on the bench.
"I was going to find a dealer, but it bothered me that you were gone and I didn't know where you were. I started to think maybe you'd left me behind."
"You wouldn't have cared once you took the Kef."
"But I didn't have the Kef," she said, voice surprisingly reasonable. "And then I went to the front and found you'd checked out."
"And you decided to find me and not the Kef," I said. "I don't believe you."
"I don't blame you."
She was silent for 5 seconds.
"I've been sitting here, thinking. I accused you of hating me because I was better than you."
"That's not why I hate you." She ignored that.
"Amat's grace, that fall. It was my own stupid fault. I was sure I was dead. And if it had been the other way around, I'd never have jumped to save anyone's life." "You never knelt to get anywhere. You're where you are because you're fucking capable and willing to risk everything to do right. And I'll never be half what you are, even if I tried my whole life. And I was walking around thinking I was better than you. Even half dead and no use to anyone, because my family is old, because I was born better."
"That," I said, "is why I hate you." She laughed as though I'd said something moderately witty.
"If that's what you're willing to do for someone you hate, what would you do for someone you loved?"
I found I was incapable of answering. Fortunately, the doctor came in, broad, round-faced, pale, frowning slightly, slightly more when she saw me.
"It seems," she said
in an even tone that seemed impartial but implied disapproval,
"that I don't understand your friend when he tries to explain what happened."
I looked at Save Arden, who made a helpless gesture, and said,
"I don't understand any of it. I tried my best, and the whole day she's been giving me that look, like I'm biological waste she stepped in."
"It's probably just her normal expression." I turned my head back to the doctor. "We fell off the bridge," I explained. The doctor's expression didn't change.
"Both of you?"
"Yes." A moment of impassive silence, and then,
"It doesn't pay to be dishonest with your doctor."
And then, when I didn't answer,
You wouldn't be the first tourist to enter a restricted area and be injured. You are, however, the first to claim they'd fallen off the bridge and lived. I don't know whether to admire the brazenness or be angry you take me for such a fool.
Still, I said nothing. No story I could invent would account for my injuries in the way the truth did.
Members of military forces must register on arrival in the system, the doctor continued.
I remember hearing so.
Did you register?
No, because I'm not a member of any military force.
Not quite a lie. I was not a member. I was a piece of equipment. A lone, useless fragment of equipment at that.
This facility is not equipped, the doctor said, just a shade more sternly than the moment before, to deal with the sort of implants and augmentations you apparently have. I can't predict the results of the repairs I've programmed. You should see a doctor when you return home. To the Gerentate.
That last sounded just slightly skeptical, the barest indication of the doctor's disbelief. I intend to go straight home once I leave here, I said. But I wondered if the doctor had reported us as possible spies. I thought not. If she had, likely she would have avoided expressing any sort of suspicion, merely waited for authorities to deal with us. She hadn't, then. Why not? A possible answer stuck her head into the room and called cheerily,
Breck, you're awake! Uncle's on the level just above. What happened? Your friend seemed like he was saying you jumped off the bridge, but that's impossible. Do you feel better?
The girl came fully into the room.
Hello, doctor. Is Breck going to be all right?
Breck will be fine. The corrective should drop off by tomorrow, unless something goes wrong.
And with that cheerful observation, she turned and left the room. The girl sat on the edge of my bed.
Your friend is a terrible tick-tick player. I'm glad I didn't teach him the gambling part, or he wouldn't have had any money to pay the doctor with. And it's your money, isn't it? From the flyer?
Savardin frowned.
What? What is she saying?
I resolved to check the contents of my pack as soon as I could. He'd have won it back playing counters. From the look on her face, the girl didn't believe that at all.
You really shouldn't go under the bridge, you know. I know someone who had a friend whose cousin went under the bridge and someone dropped a piece of bread off and it was going so fast it hit them in the head and broke their skull open and went into their brain and killed them.
I enjoyed your cousin's singing very much. I didn't want to reopen the discussion about what had happened.
Isn't she wonderful? Oh!
She turned her head as though she'd heard something.
I have to go. I'll visit you again.
I'd appreciate that, I said, and she was out the door and away. I looked at Savardin.
How much did this cost? About what I got for the flyer, she said, ducking her head slightly, maybe out of embarrassment, maybe something else. Did you take anything out of my pack?
That brought her head up again.
No, I swear, I didn't.
I didn't answer.
You don't believe me. I don't blame you. You can check as soon as your hands are free.
I intend to. But then what? She frowned, not comprehending. And of course she didn't understand. She had gotten as far as mistakenly evaluating me as a human being who might be worthy of respect. She hadn't, it seemed, come to the point of considering she might not actually be important enough for the Roch to send a special missions officer after. I was never assigned to find you, I said.
I found you completely by accident. As far as I know, no one is looking for you.
I wish I could gesture, wave her away.
Why are you here, then? It's not groundwork for an annexation. There aren't any more. That's what they told me.
No more annexations, I agreed. But that's not the point. The point is,
You can come or go as you like. I have no orders to bring you back.
Saevardin considered that for 6 seconds and then said,